So yeah, I'm going to talk for I don't know how long, probably about 25 minutes or half an hour, and Steph is recording the talk, but we won't record any sort of discussions that we have later, so because we want us to be able to speak freely. So the topic is race and the Sangha. And what I thought I would do is I would just tell my life story from the point of view of race. So that's my way into the topic. There's so many areas to cover, so many things to say. This I thought was the best way for me to just sort of go into the territory, if you like. And I found it quite interesting just reflecting on my life story from that perspective. We've got a great tradition within our tradition of telling life stories, and I've told my life story in many different contexts over the years. It's just interesting, and it's always different when you tell your life story. Different things always come out, so I just found it quite interesting giving it this particular angle. So it will be a very particular take, a very individual sort of take. So, you know, race encompasses, you know, many different areas, many different groups. My own background, you know, my dad was Nigerian. My mum is a white English woman. So my own perspective will be, you know, from that background in a way. Welcome.
Sorry, I'm late.
No, good to see you. Yeah, so, and it will be from a UK sort of perspective as well. So I was born in East London, grew up in the UK. So, you know, it's that particular, that's sort of my background in a way. One thing I was thinking about was even sort of before my birth, what was happening in the world that my parents, it's a strange thing to say, conceived me in. So I was born in January 1969, and I sort of traced back, you know, 9 months, and it takes me probably to about April 68. So I was thinking, like, what was happening in the world in April 1968? You know, it's a very, very interesting time. Mm-hmm. And the two things that I particularly sort of focused on, one is it was the month in which Martin Luther King was assassinated. It was also the month in which Enoch Powell gave his Rivers of Blood speech. Again, I could say a lot about that, and hopefully it's sort of familiar to us. You know, this was a speech that Enoch Powell, who was a Conservative MP at the time, gave in Birmingham. And one of the things that was said was that, in 10 or 15 years after that time, the black man would have the whip hand over the white man. So it was a speech, an anti-immigration speech, and there was talk of, you know, repatriation, those sorts of things. That was something that was happening at that time. So, you know, this is a couple of just examples of, you know, the climate in which my parents decided to sort of get it together, you know. Late 60s. My dad came to the UK early to mid 60s. I can't remember the exact year. My mum was born in Essex, you know, just east of London. And they met in a factory in Barking, which is where my dad was working. My mum had trained as a nurse at the London, one of her good friends at that time, Eileen, died last year. Eileen met her future husband around that time as well at Queen Mary. I was talking to my mum about this around Eileen's death last year. Eileen's husband is known as Q. He's a Bangladeshi man, beautiful, dignified man. They met around that time at a dance at Queen Mary. My mum, I think, visited my dad's factory as a sort of industrial nurse, and that's where they sort of met. We lived in Plaistow. So I was born in Stratford in East London. We lived in Plaistow. And we went to a church called St. Sed's, which was, again, just very, very sort of interesting multicultural place. And another memory from around that time, going to school in that area, I went to Ranelagh Junior School. It was the time of National Front as well. I had a friend called Tony at school, a black kid, and I remember at a certain point there was must have been some election time, and there was a car, you know, one of those political vehicles with loudspeakers driving past. And I think it was a National Front thing. And I remember him just running over to the school gates and sort of hurling abuse at them in a way, you know. And I didn't know, I was sort of quite naive. I was thinking, like, why is he doing that? And I just had this sort of conversation with him. And what I remember him saying was, I think he said something like, oh, they want to send our dads back. That was his explanation. You know, I would have been probably 8 or something like that, you know. So that's sort of early political race consciousness raising for me. So it's the time of the National Front in the East End. And I mean, this is going to be a whistle stop tour because I do want to leave lots of time for discussion as well. So I'm just, you know, giving a few memories in a way from growing up and also sort of later on coming to the Sangha. Another thing that happened was my mum, who's an only child, my grandparents on that side of the family retired to Norfolk around this time as well, and we were travelling up to Norfolk a lot to look after my grandfather, who was unwell. I think he'd had a stroke. We'll just give a little bit more background to the different sides of my family. So yeah, as I say, my mum, working class white woman, only child. My dad, Nigerian. He was the eldest of 20 children. So again, 20 children. So my grandfather, my Nigerian grandfather, had 4 wives, they were from Warri. My grandfather, who I never met, was the chief of the clan in Nigeria, which is why he was able to have, you know, so many children. I just sort of say a few words about that to talk about the contrast between the different sides of my family. It's really quite extraordinary. You know, I still find it extraordinary that, you know, these two people met, and, you know, so this is my family background, you know. As I say, at that time we were traveling a lot to Norfolk, and at a certain point my parents decided we would move to Norfolk, so we moved actually to Norfolk in 78, so I was 9 years old. So me, my 2 brothers and parents, we moved initially to a town called Thetford. And when I say that, people think, oh, there must have been a great culture shock in that move. So, you know, but actually the culture shock was a bit different to what you'd expect. So when we moved to Norfolk, to Thetford, we basically lived on a big council estate in Thetford. And it was a council estate really that was set up post-war to do with overcrowding in urban centres, you know, particularly London. So it was set up sort of as an overspill, or as a way to address post-war overcrowding. And the culture shock was, it was much rougher than where we'd moved from in Plaistow. it was quite something actually, and it was very multicultural, you know, lots of different going to school, lots of different sort of people from different racial backgrounds, I enjoyed the school, but there, you know, it was rough as well. There was a kid in the school whose house sort of backed onto ours, he basically beat me up at a certain point, completely sort of unannounced. Not that you would sort of announce these things, you know. But, you know, there was, we hadn't had any sort of interaction. And, you know, the other thing he did at that time was he threw a golf ball through our window. So, you know, of our house. So, you know, there's different ways of interpreting that. But, you know, for me, it's obvious that it was a race thing. It was he was targeting us because of the sort of family background, because of race. I didn't sort of go into that with him, but I just sort of know, you know, I've got a, you know, strong sense of, you know, that was the reason. Partly because it was so rough. My parents decided we would move. Hi there. Yeah, welcome. Yeah. So my parents decided we would move to a town called Swaffham, and you know, for those who know Norfolk, Swaffham, well, Swaffham is a very traditional Norfolk market town. Mm-hmm. When we moved there, it really felt like you know, we were the only sort of black family, mixed race family in the county. You know, that is really sort of overstating it, but it did sort of feel like that. When I was going to school, you know, there's me and my brothers, and there was one other black boy who came to the school for a short period of time. But, you know, it was sort of us, basically, I think. And so that was when the culture shock, in a different sort of way, you know, hit, you know. And one of the things about that time was just feeling very visible. So very visible. You know, one way of talking about race is in terms of visibility. Again, that doesn't exhaust the topic at all, because there's many different ways, many different forms of discrimination, of course, but, you know, visibility is definitely part of the story, of course, in terms of in terms of race. And at that time, yeah, I felt very visible. And, you know, you know, positive and negative consequences of that. At school, I feel very fortunate that my parents, you know, we moved to that part of the world. I got lots of opportunities, I think, from that. Mainly, I think we were just quite an exotic species. You know, because we were sort of just, we were on our own as a family in a way. There wasn't, I don't think there was much overt sort of racism that I experienced. You know, racist jokes were just part of the norm, even from my friends at times. You know, that was just sort of part of being there. But when I say overt racism, I mean, you know, people who want to, you know, physically assault you. But there were one or two kids who I knew I would just need to avoid. I would just try not to be isolated with them. One example was, and this is at high school now, going into a cloakroom, which is quite a sort of small sort of space, and this kid was there, and I just knew that I had to get out of there quickly, you know. So, you know, there were kids like that who I just knew I had to avoid. Another memory, in a way, you know, these aren't very live memories in a way, but, it's from sitting down and reflecting on this that I've sort of dredged some of this up, you know. And I remember after a while we moved to a village called Necton, which is 4 miles from this market town of Swaffham. So I used to get the school bus every day. And we used to have this, we used to divert to a farm to pick up a kid from this farm. So it's in between my village and the market town where I went to school. And there was one day where we were dropping this kid off, and he just, as he walked past me, he said, "Why don't you, you know, go back to where you came from?" You know, so that was him, you know, doing that quite publicly on the school bus. And I don't know. I don't know if I was sitting with my friend, so Kate Rosenberg. So she's from a Jewish family, and she's one of my school friends I'm still very much in contact with, and I love her dearly. And I remember us sort of talking about that at that time, you know. So there were incidents like that. I mean, I don't want to, I want to mention them, but they were quite rare. So I think I was actually really fortunate, but they were very much there, of course. And yeah, I do also want to mention my football team. So there's a particular reason why. There's a reason that's relevant to this discussion, and there's a reason that's not relevant to this discussion. I'm going to mention both. So when I was in East London, I decided for some reason to support Nottingham Forest Football Club, and I've been dealing with that decision ever since. You know, I was too young really to make that sort of weighty decision at that time, you know. And yeah, I mention it because my favourite player was the goalkeeper, who was the England goalkeeper, Peter Shilton at that time. He was a white player. When I went to Norfolk and people heard that I was a Forest fan, they immediately assumed that my favourite player would be Viv Anderson. So Viv Anderson, he's the first black player to play for England, which was in 1979. And what I find interesting about it is I sort of took that on. He did become my favourite player. So I'm just sort of interested in how that transition happened. You know, it's definitely to do with, you know, sort of being in a different context and, you know, somehow being visible, you know. So I had a Forest shirt with the number 2 on the back, which was his number. And he is still a great hero of mine, actually, you know. The non-relevant reason that I wanted to mention my team is they are top of the table. And it's 5 years. It's 5 years since I've been able to say that, and I'll only be able to say it for this window, these few hours. It's just because they played last night before everyone else. So I've said that, and it's recorded. So maybe in 5 years' time I'll be able to say the same again. I feel better. Thank you for listening to that one. So yeah, visibility. I mean, I was, you know, me and my family in school. We were well known in school because of this visibility. That when I was in my last year, I was head boy, and my elder brother was president of the sixth form. So we had sort of complete control of the school. You know, we had no control, no power whatsoever. But it was just sort of interesting. So in a way, that was part of being visible as well. People knew us. And I think in a way it put a particular onus on us, I think, to act well, actually, because it's almost like there was a responsibility. We were sort of representing something, I think, you know, which and probably none of this I could have articulated at the time. I have to sort of say a bit more about my dad at this time as well. So when I tell my life story, I always tell a joke that my dad told, because I think, it captures something of this time. And my friends in the room would have heard this joke probably a few times, but it's just, I think, essential to the story. So my dad was a strong Anglican Christian, so we would go to church. My mum's Christian. My dad died 19 years ago and is buried in the churchyard in Necton, where we used to go to church. There was this one time we were living there, and we were at the vicar's at the vicarage at a barbecue, there was someone in the congregation who wanted to sort of talk to my dad, I think, about race, you know. And part of the difficulty with race is we're such a sensitive area, isn't it, and it's so difficult to even approach sort of talking about it, but this person this person's way into sort of talking to my dad about it was to talk about food. So it's a barbecue. I picture my dad having, like, you know, a leg of chicken in his hand. And this brave person said to him, you know, what do people eat in Nigeria? You know, that was their way in. And my dad just said, missionaries. So that was his response. which is, you know, it's inspired, and I think it tells you something about my dad. You know, so my dad was a real extrovert to the point where I was embarrassed by him for a lot of the time as a kid. At a certain point, I started appreciating his humour and his extroversion and his outgoingness. And the other thing to say, I think, about that time was I remember my dad coming back from work. So he was still working, you know, in a factory. You know, he's a metal worker. And I remember him coming back from work one day and just saying to me that somebody had, like, racially abused him at work. And this was after quite a few years, I think, in Norfolk. What shocked me about that was how outraged he was, actually, that I got the impression that he was surprised, or that this was one of the first times it had happened. So that's the thing I was most shocked about, I think, when he said that to me. And I think there's something for me about, there's something generational about that. Mm-hmm. You know, so when you go to school, you know, kids are sort of brutal at times, and you go into all these areas. My dad, you know, came to this country in the 60s, and so, you know, he grew up in a very different sort of cultural setting or whatever. Mm. So he didn't grow up with the sort of racism that I did, you know, and it's obviously a very sort of individual thing. So yeah, the thing that shocked me was that the impression that this was quite a new thing for him. I just mentioned that incident. Okay. I'm going to say a bit about coming to the Sangha, so coming to this Buddhist tradition. My dad's death was definitely a big part of my coming to this centre. You know, he was so important in my life, you know, he was such a good friend to me. I mean, same with my mum. I was closer to my dad than I am to my mum. I think my two brothers are probably closer to my mum, but, you know, so my dad was very, very important to me, very positive influence on me. So when he died, it was like an earthquake, and it was like trying to make sense of what had happened, you know, and that's very, very sort of short way of saying that's how I found my way here. Maybe I'll just try and say a few words about, you know, being in this Sangha. One of the first things I read or studied, I remember being on a solitary retreat and reading Bhante Thangarachra's book on what is the Sangha. And he goes into the spiritual community and the group and the individual. That teaching is very, very important to me. I don't think I could have somehow stayed around without that formulation of the teaching. Again, I don't think I've got time necessarily now to go into it, but we could maybe go into that in a sort of discussion. But that was sort of very important to me. Trying to think about where to go next, because there's so much to say. Actually, maybe I'll just finish by talking about meeting Bhante himself. I personally work quite well in discussion and questions, and we can sort of explore some of these areas together. So, maybe I'll just finish by the one-to-one meetings I had with Bhante. So, you know, Bhante is the founder of our Buddhist tradition. You probably all know that. Bhante just means teacher. So Thangarachra, Bhante Thangarachra. So when I was thinking about whether to ask to join the order, I felt like I needed to meet Bhante. So I hadn't met him at that point, but I felt like if I was going to join his order, the order that he founded, I needed to meet him one to one. So I travelled up to Birmingham, and I was very fortunate enough to get to meet him. Again, there's a lot I could say about that, but what I want to say here is that one thing we talked about was he talked about a couple of Nigerian students coming along to the first classes that he held in what was the street called?
Monmouth
Street. Thank you, Sasan Josie. Yeah, so this is very, very early days. You couldn't even say it was a movement. You know, it's Bante giving classes, and just it was very, very nice hearing about, you know, Nigerians coming along to those classes with Bante at that time. So I guess we must have talked a bit about you know, my dad and my own background. Another meeting a few years later. So this was once I joined the order, and I was having quite a difficult time for various reasons at that time. And that's the reason I wanted to talk to Bante, just to sort of see. I wasn't expecting really Bante to be able to help me, because he didn't know me personally very well. I mean, but I was in Birmingham, I think, anyway, on a seminar, and I just asked Bante's secretary, can I see Bante? And I managed to meet him again. And one thing he said to me, which was extremely helpful at that time, was he just reflected on my name, Manjusia. So I'll say a bit about my name and then I'll say what Bante said. So my name means pleasing, charming, lion, like the Buddha, something like that. So it's very much a name with two halves. And I think partly Maitre Bandhu gave me the name. The second half is not limited to this, but it's certainly a nod in the direction of my background, my father's background. And you know, when we join the order, when we fully join the Sangha, there is something that we go forth from the group. So we go forth from mundane life, you know, in an ideal way. But so I'm so grateful that my name somehow is a connection with the person who existed before my ordination as well, and my background. And yeah, as I say, Bante didn't know me, of course. But what he said at that time was, "There's boldness in the name." There's boldness in the name. And that was just what I needed to hear at that time. So he reminded me of what was in my name at that time. So I'm going to stop there, I think. I've said a few things, particularly about my background, and particularly before I sort of came to the Sangha. But I think I'll finish there, and we can just see where we want to go with this discussion, and we'll have tea at a certain point midway through the discussion as well. Yeah. So thank you for listening, and yeah.
Thank you.